to Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Lotz, and I'm your host for today. Today, I'm really delighted to be speaking on the phone with Patricia Marie Fudd. She is the author of Hellhounds of High School, a fictional novel with much based on her own experience as being a teacher in a northern Alberta community. The book takes a close, comical, and realistic look at a Catholic school system. But before we talk to Patricia, I'd like for you to get to know her. Patricia Marie Budd was born and raised in Saskatchewan, Canada. She lived in Japan, where she taught English as a foreign language for 2 years. In her early 20s, she studied mime in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and then later in life renewed her interest in physical theater by studying in London, England. Much of Patricia's writing has been in theater, with producing a one-act play in the Rhubarb Festival Special Event in 1984. She has also participated in a number of playwriting labs under the tutelage of Sharon Pollock. In 1998, she was part of the Alberta Playwriting Committee. Patricia's first novel, A New Dawn Rising, is set near Savannah, Georgia, in the early 1800s. Patricia spent 3 years researching into the life in the 1800s and Georgia slave law whilst writing this novel. Patricia Marie Budd teaches high school in Fort McMurray, Alberta, Canada. She spent 19 years in the classroom and mostly teaching English. Her experiences qualify her to critique the educational system in a comical way, and that's exactly what you're going to find in The Hellhounds of High School. Hi, Patricia.
Hello.
Well, this is great to talk to you. Hellhounds of High School. Wow. Well, you've been in the teaching industry for 19 years, so I'm sure that you have come across a lot of hellhounds during that time.
Well, I've also been the hellhound.
No way.
The title immediately refers to the students, but there are no innocents inside the classroom. There's students, there's teacher, then there's all of those that sort of evolve around the peripheral. You've got the administration, you've got the parents who are, although people don't realize it and many parents don't, an absolute critical role in the education of their children. And then there's the high school counselor, there's friends, even friends' parents. Quite a collection of individuals that work together without even knowing it to aid each individual child's education.
Well, I can see all that on a positive matter, but Hellhounds doesn't sound very positive to me.
Well, there's also the fact that what's happening is most of these groups don't coordinate and work together, and that's because it's usually a spontaneous kind of thing, and it's very hard to connect and collect all of these groups and get them to work symbiotically, and it's kind of like education. It's like an orchestra. You've got your conductor, who I like to think of as the teacher. However, other individuals in other positions may consider themselves the conductor, i.e. administration, or your superintendent, or your parent, or even students like Gregory McGregor. And this orchestra, when all the musicians play together harmoniously, produces the kind of education and the intellect in our children that we long for. When this orchestra is untuned and the musicians are at odds with each other, you've got one person playing rock and one person playing Bach, you end up with an erroneous cacophony. And the title itself is meant to be humorous. And looking at all of the humorous and insane antics that do, in fact, happen in the high school. And I chose the title after experiencing probably the most challenging class I have ever had. It was an English 30-2 class, and in my novel I explain that in Alberta we stream our students. We have a dash one and a dash two stream, and the dash one is academically inclined and they are looking to go into university. Dash two is our general stream. And, of course, what happens is that people then decide that dash one means smart and dash two means stupid. And the students and the parents and administration sometimes, although administration and teachers and counseling will never admit this, that stigma is in their minds too. And so I've got this teacher who is battling with this 30-2 class in my book, myself, in which they're all saying, well, we're dummies, we're stupid, we can't learn this stuff, you have to give us easy stuff. And, you know, it's like, no, you're in grade 12, you're in a core curriculum class. You, if you are here, that means you can read and write. If you can't, then you're in the wrong program. It's as simple as that. And I'm here to teach you. I'm not here to teach dummies. And you're not dummies. And so
wow.
I kind of went all the way from an orchestra to battling the concept of we're dummies, miss. You can't teach us anything hard.
So once these kids get a label by society, I'm going to call it society because who knows where that label comes from, is it difficult to get them to see a different picture, that they really don't have that label as a dummy?
Yes, it's very hard. It's a battle. It is. It's and sometimes, you know, you'll get a class of, you know, really, really, really lower-end kids, and so the whole goal is to build up their self-esteem and help them recognize that, yes, they can learn. It's a tough battle when they've come to believe they can't learn.
Well, sometimes that can't learn is also comes from the home. And depending on what their home life is like, a lot of times parents are not very supportive, and maybe they have some learning challenges themselves, and in their poor self-esteem reflect onto the student.
Yes, that's very true. I find that most parents desire the best for their kids. But if they lack skills themselves, they're not in a good position to aid and push the child forward. My strongest recommendation to parents is that they read every night to their kids.
Read. Ah.
Reading is probably, it's like when you think about the body and you think about what the body needs to survive. There's a lot of things the body needs, but one of the things you cannot survive without is water. Reading is like water to the mind. Like water to the body, reading is to the mind. It is one of the most crucial elements that the mind needs to grow and build. Another sort of metaphor or analogy that I use is when you think about being an athlete. There are very specific exercises that everyone does for their specific, their specific sport. However, everyone is required to work out. You know, everyone is required to do your general workout. Reading is a general workout for the brain. It is so crucial that we have our kids reading. That's why, you know, I loved Oprah.
Uh-huh.
She really pushed literacy.
Yeah.
And she really pushed reading and how important it was to read. And if you don't read, you're weakening the mind. You're letting the mind, or you're not strengthening it, and it grows weaker and weaker.
You know, as you're talking about that, Patricia, what I'm reflecting back is my parents, specifically my mother, only had a grade 3 education, but she, you would never know that because she is so well read.
Mm-hmm.
Although because of being an immigrant and she came at a later age and it's just, you know, she was in grade 3 and 15 years old and went off to work, but she learned how to read.
Yes.
And, you know, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. And, of course, you get so many people who hate to read today. And it's always sort of been, you know, reading is work. Education is work. And that's probably the biggest problem with education today, I think, is that it is, always has been, and it always will be hard work.
Mm-hmm.
One does not simply acquire knowledge through something that's shoved into the back of their head, like in Matrix, where it's,
right,
do you know how to fly?
Mm-hmm.
I will in a second. You know, and then she asks Buddy back at the computer to download the, you know, pertinent information. It does not happen that way.
Mm-hmm.
We have to download the information through our eyes and concentrate and think and ponder and come to an understanding of it. It doesn't just zip, it's there. And today's society, everything is zip. It's there. Everything is like, I saw the most wonderful little production, a one-man Macbeth, where he introduced his one-man Macbeth show by talking about how we've gone from the three-hour play to the two-hour film to the one-hour drama to the half-hour sitcom to the three-minute YouTube video of the kitten kind of thing.
Right.
This is our attention span. Our society is pushing and creating attention deficit disorder. People, I don't think the majority of individuals are born with attention deficit. I think that as a society, we are creating it. Everything is instant, boom, 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 boom. And nobody wants to sit and look at anything for more than 2 or 3 minutes now.
Yeah, and even that's getting to be long.
Yeah, and that's getting to be too long.
Yeah.
You know, that's... So what's happening is I just did a little bit of research on this. Our frontal lobes, where most of our reasoning and cognitive skills are, is getting weaker and weaker, smaller and smaller, because the only thing we're stimulating is the, you know, the back of our brains, which are not our rational thinking, which is not where thought, intelligence, where we need our kids to go to continue developing society, to continue to, you know, advancing humanity. We're entering into, it's almost like we reached this peak of human intellect, and now everything is downhill.
Wow, that's a scary thought, Patricia. So is this possibly why more students are failing in school?
I believe this is, and that's actually one of the chapters in my book, Why Are So Many Students Failing Today?
Uh-huh.
And the irony, the paradox behind that I discuss in that chapter is... Sorry, is the fact that everything is so fast-paced today.
Yeah.
Everything is so instant. And the irony is that we have all this knowledge at our fingertips. So if I need something, I go onto the internet and I pull it up, and then I, you know, there it is, boom, I've got it, and I toss it into my essay. Now, where's the search? Where's the concentration? Where's the pondering in all of that? In fact, the internet has made cheating extremely easy for kids, because you can buy essays on it. Buy an essay on Macbeth. Buy an essay on that. And it's like cheating in the past was hard work.
Right.
I mean, you could at least acknowledge that this kid had to work his butt off to get to the point where he cheated, right?
Yeah, right.
You know, today it's like so much simpler to cheat.
Oh, sure. And like you say, you know, you just go and what do? You Google it. And it's like, remember a long, long time ago, there was the Encyclopedias Britannia?
Mm-hmm.
Those are, like, I'm sure that they've got to be collector's items now, because there's no need for them anymore.
No, they're all on, and what there was of them, they're on the internet now.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that's the thing. The other thing with the internet, at least with Encyclopedia Britannica, you knew that intelligent minds went together to put these together.
Yeah.
And created them. With the internet, you have to become very discerning and determine which site actually provides you with intelligent information versus those sites which are bogus. And that is a very important skill that kids need to learn today. And, it's a skill that requires hard work.
Yeah, it does. And, of course, as we had talked earlier, you know, the support of the parents and the teachers and everybody else around the grandparents. And so there's just that importance that I think is maybe lacking in our society now, is the communication between the parents and the student and the teacher.
Yes, and that's something that my educator in the book and myself, this is something of myself that I gave to my protagonist that is so vital. And even with all of the efforts that I make, it's almost impossible to keep constant communication. Only those parents that want to will communicate. I have what I call my contact list, my email contact. This is where technology can work in our favor. I have the email addresses of probably 98% of my parents and my students. Most students give me their email address too, because these emails are very useful. And most parents have email addresses, but there are a few that don't. So about 98% of my parents are on my contact list. And I send out daily email reports this is what we studied in class today. This is what the student needs to work on for homework. This is when the next exam is. This is the material he needs to study. And this is my way of trying to enable the parent to provide them with the tools they need to help their child in education, because the parent's role is integral. If the parent does not participate in the child's education, then there's, well, especially in those formative years, in those first 5 years of education, if the parent isn't there helping, once the child hits those preteen pubescent years, they are not going to allow the parent.
Gosh, Patricia, are you clonable? You sound like a teacher that needs to be cloned and placed into our school system. I'm serious.
The American school system paid better, I'd probably do.
Unfortunately, that's the other thing is, you know, here are teachers that are supposed to be guiding our next generation to lead our countries, mm-hmm. are one of the lowest paid.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just doesn't make sense.
It doesn't. And really, even up here in Fort McMurray, because it's so expensive to live up here,
yeah.
what I find unfathomable, I can't even imagine, and I don't know how they do it. A lot of the first and second and third year teachers have part-time jobs because they can't afford to live up here with the high rent, the high cost of living. They cannot afford to live up here on their wage. And I'm remembering my first and second year of teaching when I can't even imagine being out there working. It's just like my whole focus was my job. My whole focus was you know, teaching and figuring out how to present the material to the students in effective ways. And I think about, holy crap, there's no way I would ever want a part-time job in my first 5 years of teaching.
Well, exactly. In your day, I mean, we think that a teacher, okay, you know, they teach from 9 to 3:30, but that is not so.
Oh, God, no.
I mean, that's maybe that's when they're in front of the class, but there's all that prep work and...
And marking.
And marking, exactly.
And now, although the wages haven't increased, there's greater expectation. Not only is the teacher expected to do extracurricular, it's usually a part of your contract that you participate in at least one or two extracurricular activities. There's also this expectation of what's called extra help, which most teachers were doing anyway, but they've now made it an expectation as a part of the job, so that you're not leaving the school anywhere before 4 or 4:30 or 5 o'clock.
Ah.
You're getting there. You know, most teachers get there a half hour early.
Right.
Simply because it's, you know, you don't want to show up 2 seconds before the bell and start teaching. And if some people can do it, but I can't.
Uh-huh.
You know, more power to you if you can. But, you know, most of us meet at about 7:30 and we sit in the staff room and we visit and we psych ourselves up for the classes and then we go and we teach. And lunch hours are not always free because we have supervision and we have extracurricular, and then there's after school. They're not usually free because we have extracurricular and extra help. And then evenings, whoa, we're getting some wind here. Our door just slams up with that. Then there's all the planning and the marking. And then there's the contacting of the parents. Yeah. And, you know, the emailing the parents is a very valuable tool. I can't stress enough how incredibly useful this is, and especially for educators who don't have a lot of time on their hands. It works for the majority of your contact home. And there's still the phone calls that have to be made, you know, when
somebody
does something really absurd like fart in another boy's face. It's always better to phone home on that one, which, of course, is an incident in the book.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. I'm Juanita Watson, the host of the show, and invite you to join me as I bring to the air both well-known and upcoming writers. You will hear my guests talk candidly about their books, their life experience, specific topics, and the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, my intention is to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are syndicated and archived for availability 24/7 through direct podcast and MP3 download. And as always, I love to hear from listeners. Have a look at our website, InsideScoopLive.com. Send me an email, comment on previous guests, and let me know who you'd like to hear on the show. I'll do my best to bring you your favorite authors live and direct.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with author Patricia Marie Budd, author of Hellhounds of High School. Interesting chat, isn't it? Stay tuned because we're going to delve more into our society's role in shaping our next generation, as well as finding out the status of kids using drugs and alcohol at an early age, or the prejudices against gays and lesbians. Patricia, let's go just kind of reflect back to 19 years ago when you started teaching to now. I would assume, because I do know where Fort McMurray is, being that I'm from northern Alberta and lived in a small community. My experience living in a small community and raising our children at that time, we really did not have a lot of exposure to drugs and alcohol or gay and lesbian students. That was just something that was kind of talked about, but it really didn't come out in when I was raising my kids. But I'm wondering what your experience, let's say 19 years ago when you first came into the teaching profession, to what it is now with things like drugs and alcohol and with the students, and I understand kids are starting to become alcoholics at the age of 12 or 13, or the acceptance of gay and lesbian students. And let's talk about the changes.
Well, 19 years ago when I first came, I guess, you know, I've always been a bit of a magnet for the gay and lesbian students. In my second year of teaching, one of my students came out to me, came and told me that he was gay. And it's been happening almost annually ever since then, you know, that they've recognized that I'm someone that they can come to and talk to and be safe with and not be judged. The thing with being in not just, you know, a Catholic school, but in, you know, any kind of religious-based institutional school, there's the inborn, inbred sort of natural prejudice towards homosexuality. Now, there's the we're not prejudiced against the homosexuals. You know, we love the sinner, we hate the sin. But even that I find is piffle, because, you see, nobody condemns me because I married my husband and, you know, we have our relations, because we're a man and a woman. But a perfectly loving homosexual couple, gay or lesbian, are condemned. And it's, you know, like nobody, we really don't condemn excessively the, you know, the men and women who are out there, you know, being very promiscuous. But we will condemn the homosexuals who are promiscuous. They're the perverts. We assume immediately, like when we think of pedophilia, we immediately assume that all gay men are pedophiles. But that's not right. That's not fair. That's completely wrong. And you have to recognize that the majority of pedophiles are actually heterosexual.
Exactly.
But the minute we learn that someone is a heterosexual man, we don't think, oh my God, he's probably a pedophile. I don't want my children around him. And so now we go into the high school environment, and there's a great amount. Even today, we still have that prejudice where kids are freaked out by the gays and the lesbians. And there's still the cases, you know, where they suffer from a substantial amount of abuse. Now, I'm quite opposed to that, of course, and I always catch my kids when they talk about, oh, that's so gay. I tell them, you know, that is a, well, racist comment, I guess. I don't know how to, it's like, you know, when you're anti-Semitic, that's racist in its own way. Anti-faith thing. And I say, you know, you don't say things like you jewed them down. You just don't. Why? Because it's wrong. And, you know, in the 1930s and 1940s, that perfectly normal, acceptable mentality was what allowed for a maniac to have over 6.5 million Jewish people murdered.
Right.
And so even though, you know, we look at it today and well, that's so gay, and it's like, you know, you, if there were to be, you know, someone as crazy as Hitler, and I hate to say it, we have an economic environment that could allow for that. This is what happened in Germany, okay? The economic crash in Germany and Hitler coming in and rescuing them.
Yes.
Literally. Okay. And, you know, it's like, who do we pick, Hitler or the communists? Well, let's go with Hitler. Did we make the right choice? I don't think so. You know, would the communists have been any better? I don't know, because then you look at Stalin. But what you've got are people who take full advantage of the environment and manipulate it. And it only takes a small percentage of the population to do that. So you've got this attitude towards our homosexual kids, and they're in a Christian environment or whatever kind of environment they're in that says that your actions are wrong. I mean, I imagine it would be the same in an Islamic school where their actions are deemed inappropriate and unacceptable, or a Jewish school,
exactly.
Or, you know, even our public schools, because, you know, still we are freaked out by them, and that's, you know. So I've got my character, Frank, who looks like a girl. And there's a lot of young men in their early youth, you know, in their preteen, teen, early teen era, who look very feminine. And some of them never lose that feminine appearance, and that is poor Frank. And on top of that, he grew a breast, his left breast.
Mm-hmm.
He had to have it removed, the gland removed. But while the breast was there, he really looked like a girl. And so he was, you know, deemed the fag on campus. Whether he's gay or not, and I leave that completely open, because, you see, Frank is never given a chance to choose. The choice was made for him by his peers based on his appearance. And that's the thing, is that our sexuality is very private, it's very personal, and it's each individual's choice. And as a society, we have chosen for everyone, you must be heterosexual.
Which is really unfortunate. But that seems to be, it's changing. And I understand in Canada that people of same sex can get married, and it's legal.
Yeah, in most provinces, we have provincial.
Oh, it's still the provincial.
It's still thing.
Okay.
I'm in Alberta.
Okay.
This is not the best province in Canada to be gay.
So, the gay and lesbian students, how are they accepted, in your school, by the non-gay and lesbian? Are they accepted, or?
Today, reasonably well.
Uh-huh.
Reasonably well. And mostly the lesbians, I'll be honest with you. We have, as a society, we've rather warped perspective on what what's acceptable is gay.
Uh-huh.
Gay men are still not accepted to the same extent as lesbians, and that's because heterosexual men have some kind of warped philosophy that lesbian women like to have them around.
Uh-huh. Maybe they just feel safer.
Yeah, they feel safer.
Yeah.
They seem to think it's really sexy and all this other kind of crap. And, you know, and our media has promoted that, you know, two women together is really hot and sexy for the young man. And, you know, it's like, okay, whatever. So lesbians get a slightly easier shake, I guess, than the gay man, than the young man. I can't get into specifics because, you know, I've got incidences that I'm very well familiar with students of my past, you know, in terms of what's happened with them and, you know, of course, you know, they've been ostracized by family and friends and the kinds of abuses that they've gone through, which is very unfortunate.
Yeah, it is unfortunate.
I have seen it, you know, I have seen it. I see it continuously, and we have, you know, debates in class on, you know, about, you know, attitudes towards homosexuals. And it's slowly improving. But the entrenched prejudice is still there.
Well, let's just hope that it does change in the next, for the next generation at least. What about drugs and alcohol? You know, as I say, that mentioned earlier, that it, anything that I read, it just seems that these kids are starting to drink and become full-fledged alcoholics at the age of 12 and 13.
Yeah, a very young age. It's like
what?
Yeah. I remember when I was a little kid in school in grade 6 being stunned at having met this girl who had already had alcohol.
It might have been only a sip, too.
It was like, yeah. You know, it's like, you've been drinking? And it's like it totally blew me away. And now I'm thinking, I don't think that's so unusual today. I think in the junior high, the grade 7, 8, and 9s, that it's a very predominant part of their lifestyle. And sex is a very predominant part of their lifestyle as well.
Yeah.
And I don't avoid the fact that these kids are having sex. I mean, they are. You know, it's a part of their lifestyle today. And,
well, and I think that our society, too, brings that on because, you know, how many programs on TV, the sitcoms or any program on TV, there's usually a bedroom scene, unless it's a Hallmark movie.
Well, even then, think about American Pie. This was the classic American teenage film. The boys had to get laid before they graduated grade 12.
Yeah. That's an old movie, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had to get laid before they graduated grade 12. It was as simple as that. If you hadn't been laid by the time you graduated grade 12, you are a loser. And this was more important than anything else. This, like, where was the education and all of this? This was the most important element of their life, getting laid before graduating grade 12.
That's scary. That is a scary thought. And that's, you know, that, as I say, that's an old movie, but it's reality. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, Patricia, Hellhounds of High School. What inspired you to write this book?
The 30-2 class that nearly drove me insane.
Completely
outrageous. They challenged me like nobody's business. They know exactly who they are, two of them have already bought the book. And in fact, there was an incident in that particular class where the boys were playing the penis game. Now, I hope that's acceptable to say on radio.
It is. On this one, yes.
That's good.
Tell us about the penis game.
The penis game is this notorious little game that two boys play, and they literally volleyball the word penis back and forth. They start off at the softest sound they can make, and then the next boy has to say it just a little higher, just a little louder, and they keep volleying the word penis back and forth until the teacher hears the word and recognizes what they're doing and kicks them out. Well, kicks the one boy out, and then the other boy stands up and acknowledges that he was a part of the game and leaves with him. And now, this is in normal circumstances, in a regular class with normal kids, if they were to play the penis game, they wouldn't get kicked out. They would be like, okay, guys, let's grow up, all right? But in this class, after a couple of months of in dealing with the insanity and the F word left, right, and center and this, that, and the next thing, and God only knows everything that they did, at that point, it's like the straw that broke the camel's back. And it's like, okay, just get out if that's all you want to do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so after they played the penis game, it was near the end of the class. Anyway, the bell rang, I went to the computer, and I wrote this line, "The boys were playing the penis game today." And that was it. I went, okay, I've got a book. Definitely got a book. And then I went, and it's called Hellhounds of High School. You guys are the Hellhounds of High School. And they thought that was great.
That's too funny. Yeah. Well, and of course they are, aren't they? But then, you know, as you had mentioned earlier in our chat here, that it's not only the students.
Nope. It's parent, it's teacher, it's administration, it's everyone involved in this individual's life in that sense. You know, it's society. Society is, really, we are promoting this behavior. We are promoting this ridiculous, goof-off mentality.
Yeah.
We have really taken it and exonerated it and made it really, really, really cool.
Now, you've chosen to this book, Hellhounds of High School, to call it fiction, humorous fiction is that. How much truth is it?
I've given my protagonist about 40% of myself.
Of yourself?
Yes.
And the others?
All the other characters are fictional.
But based on reality?
Based on what it's like to... I tell my students there's a drop of every student I ever taught inside them. But there's no one student that I've actually ever taught or no one teacher that I've ever actually worked with. Like, for example, there was a time in class where a boy farted in another boy's face. And that was like a 10-second episode. Oh, my God. I can't believe you just did that. Did you just fart in his face? Will you please leave my classroom right now? We're going to discuss this later.
Mm-hmm.
Absurd. And that was it. But I turned it into this wonderful little... opportunity for Greg to, you know, really play out.
His
sort of shenanigans. And a lot of what happened to Mary as a teenager happened to me in high school. And a lot of what happened to Priscilla as a young woman, as a teenager, happened to me in high school.
Uh-huh.
And in terms of teaching styles, she and I are similar, but not quite the same.
Uh-huh.
I had to, because in a way this book is to honor my students, the kids that I've taught and will teach and are teaching, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I had her be a mime, and just like I did. I studied mime. And so every year for the last 19 years, seven times a year, because we work on a semester system, four classes one semester, three classes another, seven times a year I am asked to perform the gorilla for my students. Because in my first year of teaching, in my first semester, I was trying to encourage personal response by adding my own personal response to something, and I told them all about being a mime, and that was it.
And that's carried on from class to class, obviously.
It's like an entrenched tradition. I say that to my teacher, Mrs. Bird, and every year she gets asked by her students, and every year she gets up on the desk and she beats her chest and she grunts and acts like a gorilla, and they just love it. And they do. The kids think it's absolutely hilarious.
I bet they do. So there you go, listeners. Hellhounds of High School by Patricia Marie Budd. This book is a blast, so I really encourage you to check it out. But, you know, there's some reality, as you have heard so far, too, that underlies all this, and I encourage you to check it out. Also, Patricia, your website address?
www.patriciamariebudd.ca.
That's Patricia Marie Budd, B-U-D-D, .ca, because she is from Canada.
Yes.
Thanks, Patricia. This has been such a pleasure, and I know eye-opening for some of our listeners, too, because when we talk about the reality of the kids in school right now, it's there, and I really thank you for bringing us to light.
Well, thank you. I hope that people will pick up Hellhound and laugh long and loud, but also recognize where education is heading and what...
Yeah.
Hopefully we need to do to not allow our youth and our future to be, I believe the expression is, dumbed down.
Yeah, yeah. Well said. Thank you very much. Thanks, listeners. I hope you enjoyed this interview. This is Irene Watson with Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.